Thank you very much, Dan and Phoebe. Wonderful testimonies to hear what God is doing in your lives. I'd like now to introduce to you a dear friend of mine, Michael Ramsden. Known Michael for a number of years, and he's been a great inspiration and encouragement to me. Michael is the European director of RZIM Zacharias Trust, the European branch of Ravi Zacharias International. And I could say a lot about Michael, but I think after you hear him, you'll understand more than I could tell you. He directs the trust. He works as an apologist and an evangelist, traveling through the UK and around the world, and God is using him more and more with each year. Very effective on university campuses and with other venues, business people as well. Michael lectures in Oxford at the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics and is a very engaging and passionate Christian, and I think you'll really be blessed as you hear him share this evening. So, Michael, please come and speak to us what God has given you.
This point in the evening, in case you're wondering, we're running about 4 minutes behind schedule. However, I'm running on London time, and so I'll be finished sometime tomorrow. It's a privilege for me to be here this evening and to be able to share with you, and it is a real privilege to be asked to give this talk for the C.S. Lewis Institute. Tom and I met many years ago now, and we've developed a mutual love and respect for each other. And through Tom, I've got to know the work of the C.S. Lewis Institute and also to meet Art Lindsley and some of the other staff who work there. And I can say with complete integrity before you that I think this is one of the finest ministries that I know and one of the most strategically placed and equipped ministries that I'm aware of operating anywhere. And I'm hoping that as a result of this evening, you will not only see some of the fruit that's coming out of it, but you may also feel challenged in your own heart and mind to take advantage of some of the resources which they make available. Now, I should sort of make a couple of introductory comments so you're just aware a little bit more about where I might be coming from. I was born in England, but I was raised most of my life in the Middle East. I lived in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Now, in Saudi, I heard nothing about the gospel living there. If you organized a meeting like this in Saudi, that would be a crime punishable by death. They would remove your head using an axe. It's a very effective deterrent. They have no repeat offenders. And the consequence was I grew up hearing and knowing nothing about the Christian gospel until my parents moved to Cyprus. And it was through missionaries working there that I came to Christ. Now, the Europe that I have lived in ever since that time is a rabidly secular place. And it means that sharing our faith becomes increasingly difficult. Now, what is interesting is I happen to live in a city and I'm part of a university at Oxford, which is now producing some of the world's most vociferous secularists. Some of you may be familiar with Richard Dawkins, who's a professor at the university, who has just simply written a book called The God Delusion, where he argues that it's psychologically damaging to be a Christian or to believe in God. I was intrigued by this when I started to read a book called Affluenza, where the author of that book takes some psychological studies that were performed, one published in the Psychological Bulletin in 2003, and another one which was published in the Journal of American Medical Association Journal in 2004. And let's just listen to what this guy has to say. As far as I'm aware, the writer of this or of these articles are certainly not Christians, given some of the other things they say. Much to the consternation of social scientists, on average, regular churchgoers suffer less depression or unhappiness than unbelievers. This is regardless of religion or the nationality of gender, age, social class, or ethnic background of the believer. Those with materialistic values, such as wanting money or prestige, were far less likely to be religious, and they were unhappier, drank and smoked more, and in the case of women, were at greater risk of eating disorders. Compared with non-believers, the only sort of religious people who are not protected against depression are the ones whose involvement in faith is guided by self-seeking ends. Now, isn't that interesting? According to the World Health Organization, doing emotional studies of emotional distress and mental distress, America tops the chart today at 26.4%, whereas one of the most Christian nations in the world ranks at 4.7%. I wonder whether, as we look at secularism, whether the amount of damage that's being inflicted on the world in which we live, whether it's actually coming from the Christian or from the non-Christian. Now, when talking about secularism, what I would normally do is point out all of the errors and the fallacious arguments which are sometimes offered in order to support it. But what I would like to do instead is simply suggest you read a book that's written by a colleague of mine, Alistair McGrath, recently called The Dawkins Delusion. And that will answer most of the questions that you may have. The endorsement on the front of the book is written by one of the world's leading atheists, Michael Ruse, who simply says that reading Richard Dawkins' argument for atheism made him embarrassed to be an atheist, and Alistair McGrath has shown why. And so I would suggest that you have a simple look there. Instead, what I would like to do is read a few verses of you from the Gospel of Matthew. Please forgive me. With the tiredness, I sometimes miss out the occasional word. So if I, at one point, contradict myself, and you can resolve the contradiction by putting the word not in the sentence, it just means I'm tired. The most embarrassing speaking experience I actually ever had was speaking at a conference where I was tired, and what I meant to say was, a lot of us as Christians are waiting for perfection before God can use us, but that isn't true. Both Wesley and Whitfield had disastrous marriages, yet God worked very powerfully through them. What I ended up saying, because I was tired, was I can really relate to Wesley and Whitfield. They both had disastrous marriages. My wife, who was in the audience, was not impressed. Let me read to you from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, some well-known verses, starting at verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its taste, how should its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Now, I'm sure you've heard many, many sermons on salt and light, and they tend to go something like this. What does salt do? Well, it illuminates, it casts warmth, and it attracts, and there we've got three good points. And what does salt do? Well, it preserves, it flavors, and it's a disinfectant. And you've got another three good points. And since most preachers were sent to schools which were taught them to preach on three good points, that's basically how it goes. And all of that is valid, and it's all in the text. The trouble is, I never went to seminary. I was trained as a lawyer. So there are 13 points that strike me about this passage, many of which were pointed out to me by a friend of mine, Dr. Ken Bailey. And I would just like to take a handful of those and phrase my remarks around those. I don't know if ever, when you've read those phrases, you've often wondered why Jesus Christ takes three short parables back to back in order to make one simple point. And one of the reasons is there's a series of contrasts that come out between salt and light, and even between the two different lights, which are very helpful for us to understand the nature of Christian mission as Jesus understood it. The first one is to do with distance. You see, light can operate at a distance. I can hold a light in my hand here and illuminate the back wall. And there's a part of the gospel that can be broadcast. And that's the part of the gospel we commonly refer to as preaching. Now, some people have lost faith in preaching. I can remember speaking in a church a while ago and the guy saying to me, Michael, look, we know you're an evangelist, but there's no point giving an appeal here. No one's been saved in this church for the last 30 years. It was almost like a badge of honor, as if, you know, it would be a shame to break this extraordinarily good run that they've had. But of course, saying that to someone who thinks of themselves as an evangelist is like a red rag to a bull. So we ascertained from the pastor that there were 9 visitors there that morning. And so I preached, and I came to the end and said, if any of you have listened to this and you now realize that you need to repent and put your faith in the person of Jesus Christ, I'd ask you to stand. And 8 of the 9 stood. You know, there's a part of the gospel that can be preached. It can go out with great power, and it changes people's hearts and lives. That's true just as much 2,000 years ago as it is today. And that is because preaching has always been a counter-cultural method of proclamation. There was never a time when preaching has been popular. Okay, so it's not like it's gone out of fashion. To go out of fashion, you have to be in fashion, and then you fall out of it. Yeah, see, it's a bit like me. See, I've never been fashionable, and therefore I'm not affected by the winds and change as they go through. I was in a very large Islamic country recently, which is frequently in the news. And while I was there, I got asked to speak in a madrasa that trains people in the fundamentalist Islamic arts. They were very keen for me to accept the invitation, so they offered me 8 armed policemen with machine guns to protect me, which I said to them was very kind, but when you're speaking to a room full of suicide bombers, 8 men with machine guns isn't going to help the situation, nor calm people's nerves. Well, we came to the end of the presentation, and I was asked if I would like to ask questions. And so having fielded questions about American imperialism, and which I'm very glad as a British, by the way, people are talking about American imperialism. It gets us off of the whole British Empire thing for a while. Although, the first time I was invited to speak at the White House, I just point out that if they'd like to give it back, we are willing to receive it. They've never invited me back, strangely enough. But when we came to the end and having had questions, the head of the madrasa stood up and announced, and he said this: Islam is totally different from the Christian faith. In Islam, if you respect us, we will respect you, but if you don't respect us, you leave us no option but to kill you. And so the final question came up, and I was able to share the gospel with them. And as I shared the gospel, the women who were sitting in the room wearing the burqa, so all you could see were their eyes, started to cry and pulled the veil up even to hide their eyes so you could see nothing. And then the other half of the men who were in the room also broke down into tears, and the other half looked like they wanted to kill me, which is actually a standard reaction to all of my preaching almost anywhere in the world. And as I was speaking with the guy who set up that meeting, an incredibly brave Christian pastor who'd gone and joined this group for a year, and then announced to them that he was a Christian, as I spoke to him the next day, I said, "How did it go?" He said, 13 of the imams came to Christ yesterday. You know, there's a part of the gospel which is powerful. And when it's preached, lives are changed. I'm wondering if we're losing faith at times in the preaching of the gospel. Maybe part of the problem with preaching the gospel today is that we're not very good at explaining it. And as John Piper says so well in one of his books, good news that is not explained is not only is it not news, it's not even good. And no one can understand what you're saying, which is one of the reasons why I'm so glad about the program that Art and Tom are having and executing here through the Fellows program. If you can't explain what you believe, how can you explain it to anyone else if you can't be understood yourself? But of course, the contrast between salt and light is that light goes out into the distance, but salt works differently. You can bring salt this close to a piece of meat unless it makes contact. It doesn't have any effect. There's a part of the gospel which we as Christians, the salt of the earth, cannot communicate unless you make contact with someone. Now, I was going to title this part of my talk, Reach Out and Touch Someone, but in the current cultural climate, I thought we might get sued if I advocated this. But this is to do with hospitality. It's to do with discipleship. It's to do with the Christian character that we have in our life, that people actually see as they come into contact with us. It means we're actually reaching out in the place where we live and where God has placed us and called us and put us to actually make contact with a world that is often broken and hurt and dying. We are the light. There is a broadcast and a message we have to bring, but we are the salt. And salt is useless unless it makes contact. Are you making contact where God has placed you? God has called you into every single walk of life. Some of you from the most noblest professions in the world, like doctors. Some of you are from some of the most ignoble professions in the world, professions that enjoy inflicting pain on other people, like dentists and these kinds of people. But God has placed you somewhere for a reason. Are you able to make contact? Are you salt there? There's a contrast between salt and light. We're called to be both. Second point of contrast, quickly, visibility. You know, light, by its nature, works visibly. That's part of the definition of light. You may have noticed, you turn it on, you can see. Okay? You don't turn it on, you can't see. It is the nature of light that you see it at work. But salt works very differently. Salt is invisible. You don't see salt flavoring the food, cleansing a wound, preserving the meat. It's at work, it's operating, but its operation is utterly invisible. There are parts of the gospel which operate invisibly. As a matter of fact, if you were to make them public, you would destroy them. And anyone who's been involved in a counseling relationship or a mentoring relationship will understand the significance of that. There are parts of our Christian walk and discipleship which only work because they are kept, because of the manner in which they work invisibly. A lot of what the C.S. Lewis Institute does is that kind of invisible work, which if they stood up here and told you the stories, well, I guess they'll be very entertaining. Do you know the cartoon of the pastor who's marrying a couple? And he says, if there's anyone here who knows any lawful impediment why these two may not be joined together in lawful matrimony, or any other gossip that may be of general interest to the congregation? There are some elements of the Christian faith which simply cannot be made visible. Part of the discipleship process. And part of sharing the gospel. I was in another Muslim majority country recently, just last week. And at the end of the talk there, we had the most incredible group of people in the room. There were only 50 people, it was really quite small. But the first person up in that country was the head of the Supreme Court of Justice. Someone who isn't a Christian but came up and said, I was invited here by some friends, I'm so glad they invited me, what you said was so important. If you come back to our country, I'd like to invite you to speak to our entire Supreme Court of Justice panel, because I'd like them to hear what you have to say. I said, thank you, that's very kind of you. Next person up was the Director General for Police. He brought three of the most senior police officers with him in the country. One of them came up and said, I now see for the first time that Jesus is the only hope for our nation. Christianity is the only way. Next person up was the head of the National Parliamentary Security Committee for his country, together with one of the leading opposition MPs. I had dinner with him for three hours. It was quite an interesting time watching these. One of them had just lost power, one of them had just gained power. Not that you know anything about that in Washington, D.C., of course. And at the end of it, one of them looked at me and said, Michael, I'd like you to invite you to come to speak to all of the politicians in our party. At which point, the guy from the majority party said, no, you don't. I want him to speak to ours. So they had a little argument, and we left, and the next morning they rung, and they said, okay, we've buried the hatchet. We've agreed between us we'll have a joint session. We'd like you to speak to both of us. Now, those stories sound impressive, right? You're probably listening thinking, oh, wow, that's encouraging. There is an army of people behind that story. I'm just the guy who happened to stand up at the front and talk. There are men and women of God who have been leading lives of integrity in all of these different walks of life, who opened the doors, who invited these people, who've been living as a witness, who've been sharing their faith. And they've been doing it very quietly, very privately. And indeed, if they made public what they were doing, then everything else they're doing would be shut down. Salt works invisible. Do you value the invisible work that is done? Mentoring work often appears to be invisible. You only see its results when you taste the difference it's made to the society in decades to come. What is the America you would like to live in the future in? Well, how are you investing in the next generation of Christian leaders who are coming up through this country? Thirdly, hiddenness. You know, there is a contrast between the two lights. You can't hide a city on a hill. That's what it says. And it's true. A city on a hill, you can't hide it. Trying to hide a city on a hill is trying to hide a runway. You know, when they introduced taxation in England for landing aircraft, in England, all the takeoffs you have are free. You can have as many as you want. It's just the coming back down to earth they charge you for. You know, so someone suggested a way to avoid the taxation was to put billboards around airports, which I guess you could do, but I have a sneaky feeling that the locals will notice the odd jet coming in to land. You can't hide. There are some things you simply cannot hide. City on a hill cannot be hidden. There's parts of the Christian faith that cannot be hidden. People will know whether you drive to church, walk in and out of a building, they will see you. But there are parts of the Christian faith which can be hidden. You shouldn't light a lamp and put it under a bushel, but you can. Many of us as Christians, we've lost our public voice in the society in which we live. We even wonder whether Christianity has anything public to say. When you're with your friends, your family, your colleagues, just imagine you're with a group of people who you like who aren't Christians. If you don't have any non-Christian friends, then imagine what it would be like if you had some friends. Can you speak to them? Would you feel happy answering their questions? In your place of work, if someone came and asked you a question, would you see it as an opportunity or would you see it as a danger? And then lastly, the results of failure, we're told, between the light and the salt are different. You see, a light can be relit, but salt, we are told, if it loses its saltiness, cannot be made salt again. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but salt is one of the most stable compounds known unto man. You take salt, you grind it up, what do you have? Salt. You heat it, what have you got? Salt. Okay, you dilute it in water, you evaporate the water off, what have you got? Salt. Freeze it, whatever you do, all you've got left is salt. So the question is, how does salt lose its saltiness? Well, the salt that you and I use in the 20th century has been refined. It's had impurities removed from it. But the salt of the first century either came from the salt lakes in Cyprus, or you could harvest it from the sea, but that was a very laborious and slow process. And that salt contained impurities. And if the impurities reached a certain level, the salt became so unstable, it became worthless. In the Greek text, it literally says, if the salt becomes foolish. The word translated, lose its saltiness, is the Greek word, moron. It is translated into the English word, moron. It means to be a moron. It literally says, if the salt becomes stupid, how can it be made salty again? If either the moral or intellectual impurities of our life reach such a level that we become so unstable, then in this passage we're given a very severe warning. How do we expect it to be made salty again? What is your walk with the Lord looking like right now? How do you stand before Him right now? Is it possible that we're walking and living wisely? Or is it possible that we're living and walking foolishly? We are literally becoming morons. We're not becoming morons for Him, because if we become moronic, according to this passage, it is thrown out onto the streets. There's a story of a Middle Eastern merchant who tried to corner this market in salt. He brought all the salt he could find, and he stored it, but he stored it in a place that was damp. Once it had become damp, it was worthless. It couldn't be used for anything. You couldn't eat it. It would make you ill. But then, what could he do? He couldn't put it on his fields, because if the cattle eat too much salt, they become ill. You can't put it in the river, because if you put it in the river, you poison your water source. So what did he do? Well, the proverb says that he took the bags of salt, and he punctured them, and dragged them up and down, and lined the streets of the city with the salt he had brought, and it was trampled under feet by men. This is exactly what Jesus is talking of here. We will all be asked to make two big investments in our life. One is the amount of time we invest in spending with God, learning to be wise with Him. And the other is the amount of time we spent invested with other people and how wisely we act with them. Do you know how to live, act, and work in the world in which you live? You know, we have the most glorious and wonderful gospel. Those of you who have heard me speak before may be aware of the fact that I often speak very, very quickly, much more quickly than I'm speaking now. This is simply because someone said to me, Michael, when you speak about Jesus, let your face shine like that of an angel. When you speak about hell, your normal face will do. I spend most of my time talking about Jesus. It's the thing that gives me the most amount of joy with a world that is desperately wanting to find wisdom and reality in other people's lives. You are those people. You are the salt and light of the earth. The question is, will you take enough time to make sure you live wisely, both before God and before other people, so that people may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven? Two years ago, a young lady came, again from a country I really can't name, and she said, Michael, I hear you do some training. I'd like to do this training with you. So she came and she did the training. At the end of the training, she said, Michael, I live in a country where I work for a family that's very powerful. They have a lot of difficult questions. Can I ask them to be in contact with you if I can't answer all of their questions? I said, that's okay. 6 weeks later, my phone rang, and this guy starts talking to me, asking me these questions. And I'm thinking, who are you? And how did you get this number? He didn't tell me. 10 minutes later, he mentioned this girl's name, and I thought, that's who you are. So I answer his questions. We talk for an hour. At the end of an hour, he starts to cry. He says, Michael, I am the most powerful person in my country. If billions of dollars could buy me happiness, I'll be the happiest person in the world. He said, I've looked into the eyes of presidents and prime ministers looking for oceans, and all I've seen are puddles. He said, I am desperately looking for anyone who can help me even understand the questions, let alone the answers. And this is the first hope I've had. Can I meet with you? So 3 months later, we agreed to meet. We spent 3 hours talking in the morning and 3 hours the following, 3 hours one evening and 3 hours the following morning. And at the end of that, he broke down into tears again. He said, my country needs to understand what you have to say. It's not a Christian country, is it, at all. He said, if you will come to my country, I will fly you over because you need to meet the president and the cabinet of my country to tell them what you've told me. He said, it's fine. I pay for everything anyway, so don't worry about it. He flew me to his country. You know, I've been on ministry trips for the last 10 years. Every one of those ministry trips has cost my ministry something. This trip cost my ministry nothing. He wouldn't even allow me to buy a cup of tea. We were in a restaurant. I offered to pay for the tea. He said, I'll be embarrassed to allow you to pay for the tea. I said, why on earth would you be embarrassed to allow me to pay for the tea? He said, well, I own the company that makes this tea as well. He says, and I couldn't possibly allow you to pay for a tea for a company that I own. We live in a world that is desperate for answers. The girl who opened up these doors was 28 years old. She took time out of her life to invest in getting trained to think through how her culture thinks and works, and how Christianity works, and what Jesus had to think and say, and how to communicate it to someone else. And at the age of 28, she's just opened up a whole nation to the gospel of Christ. How about you? Live wisely so that everyone may see your good works and praise your Father in heaven. That's one of the reasons why the C.S. Lewis Institute exists, and why I can say, as someone who isn't employed by it and has nothing to gain by it, that I can't think of another ministry that I'd rather endorse in a city like Washington, D.C., and ask you to consider not just simply giving to, but giving your time to, than this one. It's a privilege for me to have been here. You'll be glad to know that I am now going. Most of you will never have to see me again until we get to heaven. Until that time, I pray that you may know God's blessing and power in your life, and that he may use you for his glory. Thank you very much. Thank you.